The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
I'm Nils Zacharias, and you're listening to Eat for the Planet. On this show, we try to answer the question, how can we eat in a way that nourishes us without starving the planet? The show features conversations with food industry leaders, health and sustainability experts, as well as entrepreneurs and creative minds who are redefining the future of food. This episode of the podcast features Sedra and Mike, the co-founders of No Evil Foods. We kick off the conversation discussing the impact of COVID-19 on their business, and Sedra and Mike go into detail about how they responded and adapted, as well as the lessons they learned through the experience.
We tried our best to do what we could with the information that we had available. And we learned quickly, not only, you know, from our employees, but from other businesses and from customers that, you know, we made some missteps and we're human. We own up to that. We righted them as quickly as we could.
We also spend a good part of the conversation talking about No Evil Foods' bold social justice message and their perspective on recent events surrounding racial inequality, as well as the lack of diversity in the plant-based food space.
When everyone was going silent on social media, we chose not to be silent and just fade out into the background, but instead to utilize our platform to amplify voices and to donate and to share with our audience, who looks to us in some ways as an influencer in the space to guide and to provide information and to inspire action as well.
We touch on a lot of complicated issues with no easy answers. And I thought Sedra and Mike were refreshingly honest and open about the challenges of scaling a mission-driven food business.
The name of our company is an aspiration to do better every day. And I think within that is to evaluate almost every day, you know, the best thing to do and the best way to move forward and the best stance and the way to speak about something or the way to do business, and to sort of always have the question in your mind is like, is this the way to do this? Is there a better way to do this? Is there a different way to do it? And I think within the context of trying to make a huge difference.
I thought this one line about halfway into the conversation really captured the No Evil Food spirit and the secret to their rapid rise as a plant-based meat brand.
We are humble enough to recognize that we've, you know, got a lot to learn, and we're smart enough to look to the right people to learn it.
Trust me, this is a fascinating chat, and I hope you enjoy listening to it. Sedra and Mike from No Evil Foods, welcome back to the Eat for the Planet podcast.
Great, thanks for having us.
Thanks, Nil.
So, first question, how are you both doing? I know that's the most important question these days.
We are healthy.
We are healthy. We are good. We are busy as ever, but yeah, we're doing good.
We've got so many potential topics to cover in this conversation. Let's start with, you know, a global pandemic, because why not? I don't think this has happened before, at least not in my lifetime. I'm guessing not in yours either. So, if you look at what's happening in plant-based foods, on the surface, COVID-19 has led to nothing but positives. You know, you look at the data, sales of plant-based meat is on the rise. People are choosing healthier plant-based options. Plus, you add in the challenges that slaughterhouses and meat processing plants have faced and have become hubs of coronavirus, and the resulting sort of controversy surrounding all of that. For most companies in this space, it's been a great time in the sense that they've been able to find new customers. They've seen nothing but increase in sales. Those that had e-commerce as built in their distribution channels are suddenly seeing a flood of new customers that otherwise would not try e-commerce. So all of it seems kind of positive on the surface, right? But yet, I'm sure as you peel the layers of this onion, there's just challenges that everyone is facing and are facing. And even the companies that are doing well in this time, because let's be clear, many aren't, because they are cash strapped or they just haven't been built to deal with something like this. How has it impacted No Evil Foods? Because you are not necessarily a new company, but you're relatively new. You only in the last few years moved into a new manufacturing facility. Give me a sense of how this hit you and what the first impact was like.
Yeah, I mean, the first impact was Expo West, right? I think it was for a lot of people in the and companies in the natural food world. We were all packing our bags or already in Anaheim expecting to present and make connections and socialize and, you know, share our hard work and products with, you know, excited consumers and buyers and distributors. And it's like the big show for the natural foods world. And then it got canceled. And that, I think for anyone in our business, that is like a very defined marker of like the start of all of this. It was kind of happening, but that was just like a critical mass of like, all right, now there's like stuff's really going down. Things are really getting impacted, and it got really real all of a sudden. We already had our team out in Anaheim when that happened. So that was most of it. That was like our first opportunity to figure out, oh crap, now what? Mm-hmm. And we've done that a number of times since then, but that was the first way to, you know, I think one of the things that you hit on is that we're not a new company, and in a lot of ways we're still a startup. And I think that in some ways has really been to our benefit, because what do startups do well? They reinvent and they change and they think fast on their feet, and they're, you know, it's something we do every day, is that thinking and that shifting and that reformulating plans. So what might be seen as a big problem for a lot of people, we saw as an opportunity in that, all right, we're in California. We've got thousands of pounds of food with us. It's not in line with our mission to just trash it. So what do we do? And we shifted focus right away and connected with a lot of organizations and animal advocacy groups in the LA area. And we shifted and we donated that product to communities there. And that was the start of our giving pattern that we continued throughout COVID. And then as soon as we got back to North Carolina, it shifted to how do we protect our team? Because we were deemed an essential food business, and you know, we understood that we would be continuing to operate. And so we shifted on how do we do this now, and how do we do it better and differently than we were doing it before.
Yeah, and I think to your point, while the kind of umbrella story around plant-based has been like just sort of this strange upside to what is a very challenging situation around a pandemic for a lot of people, I think also within that umbrella, there is challenge for everybody. There are things to be grateful for. Although we're still a small company, having established or opened up a lot of new stores in the last year and a half, gave us, kind of a really great place to be in terms of retailers that were already there, that we were already on the shelves in, versus another company that maybe was about to launch somewhere or was gearing up to a launch. And they, as you kind of pointed to, you know, might be strapped for cash, might not have sort of a sales opportunity there. We were in an okay place in that respect. We had kind of a foundation. Definitely a huge challenge in the sort of focusing on our facility and our team and kind of figuring out something that nobody had a plan for, nobody had ground rules for, nobody had structure for. I mean, we've got a team that's diverse in age, but nobody's seen a pandemic since 1918. So we don't have anybody that diverse in age. So we really had to invent a playbook and look for resources. And again, I think that does point to something that we've had to do all along, is figure out how to do something we didn't know how to do. So in the one sense, it's maybe the biggest challenge that we faced as a company or as people. But it's also not dissimilar to other challenges along the way, where we were faced with something that we didn't know how to do, didn't understand, and had to look for resources and support and guidance and mentorship and coaching. We made mistakes along the way. We had to figure out what would work and what didn't work, and not everything worked perfectly. But I think, you know, we've gotten to a place now where we've established a tremendous amount of systems and processes, sanitation, employee screening.
So what it looks like now when you come into the facility is we've got this whole like roundabout screening situation going on where you come in and we have like a no contact screening for our employees at the curbside. And, you know, we're asked questionnaires and we get a no contact temperature reading. And so many things have been put into place. We've changed our workflow of how people enter the building, changed the way that our shifts, because we run three shifts a day here, the way that the shifts come into and out of the building to minimize contact. Before we could get a hold of face masks, because no one could get a hold of face masks.
It was early April.
Yeah.
You couldn't buy face masks.
I don't know if you remember that we had bandanas at Expo East, I think it was, as part of like our flag giveaway. We turned all those bandanas that we had on hand in the marketing supplies like area into face masks for people.
One of the people on our quality team, her name is Emma. She spent basically an entire weekend sewing face masks. She made like 90 face masks out of these bandanas that we already had.
Yeah.
And eventually we were able to buy, get a hold of more and whatnot so we could continue to provide them for the team. But, that was just one of those moments, round the clock sanitation. We have a person on each shift now that they spend the entire shift going through the facility, sanitizing surfaces,
doorknobs,
break room tables, counters, railings, whatever's common use, common touch, lockers. And they just do that in rounds.
Yeah.
And so we've had to build this kind of whole system on top of our existing business for COVID. We have a response team that meets every single day. We've been meeting 5 days a week since mid-March, basically. Just trying to stay on top of this. And it's evolved differently, obviously, in different regions. North Carolina, when we first started dealing with this, I think we had one case in the entire county, and it was somebody that had been here and already left back in March. And
yeah, so we're really fortunate that we're not operating under the conditions that some other companies are operating under.
But we're located
somewhere else.
On a different timeline, too, just in terms of how the pandemic has progressed regionally across the country.
I mean, it's been a challenge. Yeah, we're on top of that. We're parents, and so we've got kids that we're trying to keep safe. We've got almost 100 people here on the team that we're trying to keep safe, trying to keep income going to these people who are committed to coming here and wanting to work. And the bills don't stop because the pandemic's happening. And so we've got responsibility to them to keep them safe, but also to keep them working. And I think that's important. And that's one of the things that I've felt really grateful for, that right now we're in, a place where 30 million people are out of work. Noble Foods is in a position to be hiring. And I think that's really amazing. And I think that makes me feel personally very proud that I can offer that to our community right now, that so many people are struggling, and not that we're not struggling and we don't have our challenges, but we've been really fortunate to be able to continue to grow our team throughout this and throughout this increased demand.
If you look back, what, resources or help or support did you get, and what would have been helpful? Like, to what extent were your investors or your advisors or your board members or coalitions and trade associations you're part of, to what extent was that information sharing happening? Because it sounded like your challenges were probably unique in some sense, but also very similar to what many other companies were facing. So what kind of information sharing was going on, and how could that be done better so that next time around, maybe not a pandemic, but something else, we at least have a bit of a playbook on who to contact and how to get help?
Yeah. No, that's a really good question. And my first inclination was to start talking about the federal government. And I'm going to try not to go that hard in that direction. But I do think that there is...
Some leadership would have helped.
It starts from there, right?
Yeah. And I do think that the vacuum of leadership around this pandemic could not be understated. and I'm trying not to be super divisive, but I think that in a lot of, there were definitely moments where I think as a small company, I felt like we were pretty much left to fend for ourselves and to kind of figure this out to the best of our ability without a lot of really strong guidance and support certainly at the federal government level. Not to say so much about local or state government, because I think there was more there, but again, they were left in a bit of a vacuum too.
Yeah. Who were they looking to?
But I do think that trying to think about a couple of the places where we did have really strong resources, locally and regionally, were tied into sort of like a collective of folks in the quality kind of departments at different food and beverage manufacturers in Western North Carolina. So our quality team is tied in with folks at New Belgium, Sierra Nevada, people like Bucci Kombucha, Roots Hummus. And so there was some collaborative effort there where they were sharing best practices through email and things like that. Here's what we're doing in our facility. Here's what we're doing in our facility. And early on, that definitely was something that helped us think about what we should do, or even gauge, like, are we doing the right thing? Are there things we should do that we aren't doing? Are we, you know, are we keeping up with what other companies have figured out so far? That's definitely one place where we got a lot of value.
I'd say it's a real testament to our team, like that, going back to that gritty DIY ethic. If they didn't, because the resources were scarce, I feel like if they didn't have that mentality and that, like, all hands on deck, going to get it done sort of mindset, I don't know that we would have made it through it, because there was so much scouring of the internet, checking, you know, things changed within the course of a day. We would check information from the CDC and the FDA and other, you know, regulatory agencies in the morning. By, you know, 5, 6 p.m., the guidance has changed. The number of symptoms has changed. The, you know, recommendations for masks versus no masks versus who the hell knows what had changed. And we needed to be so vigilant and on top of it. And then work our best to communicate that fully to everybody, who people were scared, you know, understandably so. No one knew what was going on. And so I really can't emphasize enough how proud I am of the rallying that the team did to make sure that, like, the information was dug up from the depths of the internet or wherever else they could find it. And then it was, like, synthesized and translated and applied and put into processes and SOPs and, like, systems, and really manipulated to something that was useful, because the guidance, in a lot of ways, I feel like it wasn't there, and it wasn't there in a very streamlined, cohesive way. And they really did have to sort of pull it out of thin air, and they did a damn good job.
Yeah.
And I do think too, like, one thing that we could learn from this, and to some extent we did, and we knew the resources were there, but there's a very big difference between a company, plant-based or not, that is co-manufacturing versus self-manufacturing, especially in a situation like this. It's a totally different kind of scenario. And so I think even from whether it's something like Plant-Based Food Association or some other connection around plant-based companies or even natural products, food and beverage broadly, where you can kind of tap into the folks who are kind of in the same world that you are, you know, Miyoko or Tofurky or someone like that, who's also doing the same thing in terms of managing their own facility. And that kind of connection point is significant during the pandemic. And also just, I think, for any other kind of startup support in the industry as newer companies come around, because it's just a very different thing to build your business when you're making the product yourself versus when you're using co-manufacturing as your main mode of doing that.
And that's where something like the Plant-Based Food Association has offered a lot of kind of benefits to us, because we're all in that association. Anyone who's sort of a player in the plant-based industry is part of that. And they're in that association for explicitly that reason, to help make connections and help each other out. And, you know, from Michelle Simon at the executive director level to all the other positions throughout, they're all about making those contacts and saying, you know what, you're dealing with this, you should talk to so-and-so, let me make that connection. And that's, they've helped us on a number of fronts, just getting us in communication with the right people to ask the right questions and kind of find the path together.
Yeah. And, you know, of course, you mentioned the team a few times, and I want to make sure I don't want to spend too much time on this. I do want to make sure that we touch on this topic. I know you've gotten some press lately about how you handled the initial phases when you made changes in your workforce in response to the pandemic.
Yeah. You know, like I said, we tried our best to do what we could with the information that we had available. And we initially took an approach that might have been seen as a little unusual, but we've never really been too mainstream about things. We kind of do what we think is right, and we gave it a shot. And, you know, we were looking to other companies and trying to figure out how they were approaching things, and, you know, keeping in mind how other companies were approaching it. And we learned quickly, not only, you know, from our employees, but from other businesses and from customers that, you know, we made some missteps and we're human. We own up to that. We righted them as quickly as we could. And I think that we discovered that there were better ways to show our appreciation. We immediately made changes in light of that. And I think we're in a really good place now where we have a lot of understanding with our team.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, it's an interesting, we're at a sort of expanded inflection point as a company, in the sense of we've grown a lot in the last year and a half. You know, in last year, we went from 1,400 stores to 5,000 stores.
And in people, we went from about 20 team members to almost 100.
Which, okay. You know, it's a big growth in team. It's a big growth in stores, but it's also, I mean, there are something like 40,000 grocery stores in the United States alone. So we are still a very small company in the world of making, you know, food products. And so when the pandemic started, and there were, you know, understandably from all directions, employees, ourselves, a lot of fear, concern, and anxiety that continues even today on, like, what does this mean? Where is this going? You know, no one knew plant-based was going to have, you know, kind of this interesting spotlight shift around meat fat, you know, facilities. There were a lot of concerns about what does it mean if we have to shut down. Mm-hmm. That essential business thing that became part of the story wasn't really a clear thing even in that moment. So a lot of conversations like, well, what happens if our company has to shut down and we can't make product and the product's not in the stores? Will we lose customers? You know, both the people that buy the product and then the retailers will stop carrying it because we can't supply it. And that was a really, really challenging moment to figure out, well, how are we going to safely keep operating? Because I'm not sure if our business survives if we have to shut down for 2 or 3 or 4 weeks, or how long is this going
to
last?
Yeah, we ran financial models trying to figure out exactly how long we could shut down for if we needed to still stay in business.
And it was pretty
short.
It was pretty nerve-wracking, to say the least. And then the, you know, the essential business conversation started happening, and we said, okay, well, we're in a position here where we not only we can keep operating, but do we want to keep operating? Why is that important? You know, how important is it that people can access plant-based food in general, but, you know, then also to our mission, how can people be able to access quality plant-based food, not even just during this time, but overall? So it became really important to us to be able to figure out how to safely keep operating. You know, and as Sadra said, it was a challenge to negotiate that. So we didn't do everything right. You know, we made some choices that we had to pull back quickly on. But we quickly realized, you know, we now have we did a $2.25 pay raise for all of our hourly employees that started back at the beginning of April. And then we extended it indefinitely at the end of May. It was supposed to be 60 days. We extended it indefinitely because we don't know how long this is going to last. And also, I think there's really a true opportunity here to kind of assess a lot of different things. This kind of takes us into maybe other parts of the conversation around around what's going on in kind of racial justice and things like that. But this was another place where we can, as a company, kind of assess the right thing to do and how to structure our business and how to best support people across the business when that, you know, whether it's you know, wages or benefits or what have you. And, you know, I don't, it's sort of funny, I have no philosophical disagreement with paying people as much as we possibly can. And if there are different ways to look at that issue and support people on a, you know, better and better, then I'm all for it. And I'm all for trying to figure out how to do it. And this is kind of interestingly given us an opportunity to look at that, you know, more closely because of how the pandemic has shifted people's focus about kind of
what's important.
Mm-hmm. How important is, you know, we always talk about how important everybody in the company is, from the people who are on the, you know, on the production line, making the product, you know, up and down, left and right on the team. You know, we talk about that, and I think we definitely act upon it, but there's always room to reevaluate and try to do it better and more effectively.
Yeah, I think that's what I seem to be hearing consistently across the board at a, you know, personal level, as well as from people who run companies, is that this has brought everything into hyper focus in terms of what truly matters. And the things that don't have, it's become abundantly clear that those are a waste of time or not essential. And I'm sure everyone has their own version of lessons from the last few months. And the longer this continues, those new lessons will emerge in the next few months, hopefully just a few months and not years ahead. But, you know, from a standpoint of being sort of first-time entrepreneurs, at least at this level, at this scale, your company at this interesting inflection point where you've finally crossed that initial, you're no longer the tiny company selling in the farmer's market. You've now got outside investors. You've taken control of your own manufacturing. You're giving jobs in the local economy. And your brand is getting more well-known again, and you contextualize it. Yeah, maybe it's in 5,000 stores, but has a long, long way to go. By no means are you a giant food company at this point.
Yeah, I think it's important to remember, you know, we're still a young company, and Mike and I are still, we're young leaders. You know, this is the first time that we've built something like this. We're not seasoned entrepreneurs. We're not serial entrepreneurs who build companies as part of our, you know, our lifestyle. This is just something that we believe in, and this is, you know, we build this company because we believe in its mission, and we're going to have missteps along the way. And that's part of it. That's, you know, going back to those punk rock roots, you don't have to play the song perfectly. You just have to try and then get up and try again. And we're going to fail along the way. We know that. But if you're not learning, you're not living. And if you think that you're going to hit it out of the park, your first try every time, you're going to, I don't know. And that's just not realistic. I feel like we are humble enough to recognize that we've, you know, got a lot to learn, and we're smart enough to look to the right people to learn it. And I think that's why we've been able to grow this company as far as we have, is because of those reasons. And I think we're going to continue to do that. And, you know, we asked a lot of trust for our team to recognize that, like, yes, we've grown a lot. Yes, we've had a lot of success, but we're still learning every day, and we're still finding out the best way to do it better.
Mm-hmm. And looking forward, I know it's tough to predict anything anymore because things keep changing and new challenges seem to come about in this world. But looking at COVID-19 and its impact on our economy, on the food industry, on the way business is done, you know, how do you feel it changes the way you do business going forward, whether it's looking at new distribution channels, changing the way you approach retailers. I mean, as we talked before we started recording, there won't be any trade shows this year. And we started off talking about Expo West and how important it is for companies that are at your stage to be at trade shows like that. How do you go about doing what you're doing and grow your company, launch new products, keep hiring people, and build this brand in this new world we're living in, where you can't really gather in person in most places?
Yeah, it's been an interesting challenge. You know, I think that there's a couple different things. You know, I think that for one, you know, we've seen with the challenges in the meat industry, and how that has kind of shifted an even brighter spotlight on plant-based meats in particular. You know, how that opportunity, although it's a you know, somewhat of sort of I hate using the word opportunity because it's such an unfortunate scenario to have an opportunity. But I think that it's remiss to the mission not to be sort of be there and connect with those consumers when they're kind of turning their eyes to a new place in the store that they may not have put their attention before. And so I think there's a lot that can be grown from that in the long term by getting people to kind of shift or open up their focus in this moment. And they're looking for a different option, or they're turned on to the possibility of a different option. And if you can make that connection now, you can really build something that has like long lasting effects by getting those consumers interested in plant-based meats. Some of the other things about how sort of like the business is operated, I think has just taken a different level of communication and vigilance, whether that's communication with buyers, you know, making twice as many phone calls instead of having in-person meetings. Things have changed so rapidly that, you know, staying on top of, in the same way that we had to stay on top of guidance around keeping our facility safe, you all just have to stay in close touch with buyers at retailers, because they may slow down what they're doing, and then 4 weeks later, things start happening again, and you need to be in close contact with them to respond to those changes in terms of, you know, are they looking at new products now when they weren't before? Those kind of things. I think one of the other big things has been, you know, that direct-to-consumer channel. Mm-hmm. And what does that mean? What has the pandemic shown us that might have long-lasting effects? You know, being a frozen and refrigerated product, our options there are a little bit more maybe limited. But we have seen a lot of excitement around, kind of, I guess you would call it like meal box or meal kit opportunities. Like our products are available with Imperfect Foods as one of their pantry items. And that's been a huge, like unexpected jump in sales there. So I think there's a lot of opportunity there. And I'm also interested to really see, as so many more consumers that maybe weren't ready for, you know, grocery home delivery or ordering online, things like that, that were kind of forced to take advantage of that option because of the pandemic, are going to continue to utilize that going forward. And I'm not 100% sure what that means for our brand exactly, but it definitely could be kind of the big shift in direct to consumer that everybody was waiting for.
Yeah.
And it's going to kind of hold on after the fact, because, you know, you ask yourself, why would you go back if this was so much more convenient and easy and you get used to doing it? Why stop doing it? But we'll see.
I'll answer that in a slightly different way as well. I think that this is going to sound a little crass, but this happened at just the right time. And by this, I mean the pandemic. And I say that because, you know, the increased awareness of the outcome of the COVID-19 outbreaks in slaughterhouses, it's the fact that it's causing, you know, an oversupply of meat, and then these animals need to be culled unnecessarily because they're not actually being consumed at the end of that process. That has caused people, I hope, and in larger numbers, to really question their choices more than ever before. And the reason I say that the time is right now is because the plant-based community is particularly poised to be there for those consumers when they're looking for alternatives. This community of businesses and this increase in influx of new products and the better tasting and better textured products that have been coming to market in recent years, that groundwork has all been laid sort of in the background, and it's been brewing. And we've sort of got this covert plant-based thing happening where there's a movement, we're rising up, and we're ready to take on as many people who are ready to come and join our team. And so I think in that way, we're really well positioned to support those consumers who are now examining their food choices and wondering, how can we eat more consciously? And the opportunity is right.
That's true. And it's kind of how we started the conversation, right? It on the surface, it maybe there is a net positive to all of this, and it's going to take some swimming through mud to get to that point. But I do think there is going to be some shifts in consumer behavior. There's going to be some shifts in even the way the food industry works and some of the inefficiencies in in connecting with buyers and the amount of money you have to spend to go and put on a big show for them and sampling. And maybe this is, again, maybe the wrong word, but there are a lot of opportunities to be found in this, in the midst of all the struggle and the pain and the unfortunate challenges that many people are facing across the country and globally.
I was just going to say, we've always, you know, it's always been a focus of our company. I mean, you can, you're making plant-based meats and we've got a really, really strong focus on the why behind why we do that. And it's really easy to be very, very negative about that. When you talk about slaughterhouses, when you talk about how animals are treated, when you talk about health, when you talk about the environment, it's really, really easy to think about how quote unquote terrible everything is or is going to be. But we have from the very beginning, I mean, just recognize that that's not how you connect with people. And in the end, what we're doing is all about connecting with people around why to make this choice. So, you know, in a sense, we're always looking for the positive, and we always have been. How do we talk about how this is positive? How do we help people to feel like they're making positive improvement?
How do we encourage people instead of shame them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so this is just another place, I think, where we can say this is a pandemic is an obviously terrible, terrible thing. And a lot of people are hurting and will be hurting for a long time. But how can we find positive elements and then not just expose them, but do what we can as a company to have an effect there. So, you know, it's not just merely saying like, here's a positive way you can affect your life, but then even beyond that, like, how can we create positive outcomes on the other side of something that is terrible?
And I think that leads us into another topic I know, Neil, you wanted to talk about, which is, you know, the social unrest right now and the racial injustice that everyone is rightfully putting so much more emphasis and focus on. But, you know, so out of something terrible, this repeated and systemic disproportionate treatment of people of color in America, what good can come out of that, right? But so protests are happening, people are taking to the streets, people are calling their local governments, people are pushing for change. And I think that it's important to kind of look beyond the protest or look beyond the effects of COVID-19 and the unemployment to really talk about and evaluate and rebuild a system that functions. And that whether that's the food system or whether that's, you know, our police reform systems that, you know, ultimately should be taking place, it's an opportunity to revisit all of that and reimagine the way that things could be or should be.
I'm glad you brought that up. Of course, I do want to get your take on this for multiple reasons. One is because George Floyd's murder and the social unrest that has followed in the last month or so since all that happened, as much like COVID-19, has really forced people to, maybe in a different way, but take a look at their lives and their behaviors and take a look at themselves in the mirror and ask themselves some tough questions about what their stance is on some of these issues. And it's made businesses do that as well. And there's obviously a range of opinions on whether businesses should say something or whether they should not, or whether they should try to, you know, support diversity but not speak beyond that. I don't think this is a political issue. So, and I think people who are making it a political issue are missing the point and are part of the problem, in my opinion. This is bringing into focus things that have systemically been a problem in this country for centuries. And it has just brought it all to the surface, perhaps because, as many people have pointed out, we have less distractions. We're all locked up. We are sitting at home, and we have suddenly, when you watch what has happened and you look back at the history of these injustices, you can't help but not only be angered, but be forced to do something and say something. And in the context of food companies, you know, I know we've talked about this the last time you were on the podcast, No Evil Foods has been generally way more vocal about social issues and political issues. not without its negative consequences. You've often gotten pushback and criticized for it in the past about you're a food company, just sell food. But I think in this context, given the nature of inequality, it does connect a lot to what's happening in the food system as well. And one of the reasons I wanted to bring this up as an issue, and I've been asking people, and I'm going to continue asking leaders in the food industry, and particularly in the plant-based food industry, this question, is because we talk a lot about sustainability and we talk about feeding the world in 2050. And I talk a lot about that on this podcast as well. And yet we can't ignore the fact that if you look at natural food industry overall, and plant-based is, you can call it a subset of that industry, about 73% of the consumers are predominantly all white. And not only that, not only is the consumer base skew white because the products tend to be more expensive and mostly initially available on the coasts, and are not available in every retailer, and that's another challenge we need to overcome. When you look at the companies and their leadership, whether it's their boards or senior leadership, or even their teams, there tend to be a lack of diversity. So there's multiple layers to this problem. One is a systemic issue about food access and distribution, and no one company can solve all those problems. So by no means am I saying no evil or any other company should have a solution for that. But you've got to figure out where you fit into that bigger system you're part of. And then secondly, what do you do besides taking a stance and saying something on social media? Like, how do you live out those values in a way that seems like you're really, really authentically trying to solve these problems versus feel like you need to react because or you don't want to be looked upon as being tone deaf or someone who doesn't care? I know that's not a real question, but it's
a lot now.
You know, maybe I'll boil it down to one question, which is, you know, what is your role and what are you doing to be on the right side of history on this?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think veganism is undeniably linked to social justice, and this is no exception. I would echo what you said. This is not a political issue. This is a human issue. And we are very open about our stance on that. When everyone was going silent on social media, we chose not to be silent and just fade out into the background, but instead to utilize our platform to amplify voices and to donate and to share with our audience, who looks to us in some ways as an influencer in the space, to guide and to provide information and to inspire action as well. So we donated, but we also understand that like a series of social media posts and a letter of declaration of your stance and all of those things aren't enough, that this is going to be a long-term kind of commitment that individuals and companies and communities need to make and work through together. And so we've come together as a company. We're starting to do a lot of internal discussions about how we can take this on and tackle it. We've already done some trainings on these issues with 14, 15 members of our team that attended trainings. We are putting together an internal kind of action team to start to assess some of these issues and figure out ways that we can do things better. And we're committing to an equity audit as well for our company to help highlight, you know, what areas are we strong? What are we doing good? And then what areas can we improve on? And how do we do this better? How do we level the playing field? How do we right the wrongs? How do we undo the systemic damage that's been done? One of the things that I think that we've done as a company for some time is working with team members who were formerly incarcerated. And we work with a community organization that helps make referrals of qualified candidates who've been in the justice system. And, you know, 1 in 3 Americans have been in the justice system. And if you're asking certain questions in your application process, you're automatically setting aside potential candidates based on what could be, in some cases, a really minor record. And that's a really big systemic problem that we have a small opportunity to right. And so we're committed to doing that. We've been working with that organization for about a year and a half now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, we don't do, in addition to working with that organization, we don't do background checks on any new hire. So that opens up opportunity for folks who may have previously been in the justice system, regardless of that program or not too, which is might seem like a small thing, but again, it can allow for us to offer opportunities to a more diverse group of people. I think for me and for I think for No Able Foods, it's again a moment of reckoning to say, We stand behind the voice that we've put out there on social media. Those are things we truly believe. We can, make donations to organizations, which is important and valuable. But then also acknowledge, we have work to do ourselves. How can we refocus, our efforts in the right directions, in the right ways as a company to make a bigger impact, both internally and then externally? And so I think it's along the same lines as the conversation has been about, not just being, sort of not a racist, but to actually be actively anti-racist. And I think as a company, that's the way that we're approaching this is how do we be, we've always approached these things as like, how do we be more active? How do we do something instead of just say something or just sell something? So this is another place where it's like, okay, well, how do we really be actively anti-racist as a company? Mm-hmm. And I think the reality of that is, and I think in terms of some of the training that we've done and things that we've already started to try to dig into, you first of all want to sort of take your time to figure out how to do that and the right ways to do it.
The impulse is to be reactive, like you said, and just, like you're drinking through a fire hose and you just want to do all the things right away because you want to
do something.
You do something.
But that's not always helpful.
Right.
And also, acknowledging our place in the country, in the world, in terms of what we can affect and maybe what we can't, for the size of company that we are. And so I think a lot of that has to do with thinking like, how do we focus internally first or locally in our community and say, how can we be the best company that we can be? And how can we maybe build partnerships in our community that can help support, the right kind of efforts? As kind of the first steps to improving or taking steps forward, I guess.
Yeah. Also, taking it sort of beyond No Evil Foods and talking more about the industry, mm-hmm. I'd love to get your thoughts on what do you think the plant-based food industry overall? I mean, many of the companies in the space are very mission-aligned, both from a sustainability standpoint, as well as to improve food access and to kind of address this issue of food insecurity that disproportionately affects people of color. But yet I've not really seen, and part of it is because the system is stacked against plant proteins anyway. So it's not as simple as cut the price of your products and make sure it's at every corner store and bodega and deli across the country. There you go. Now your plant-based proteins are accessible by everyone. If it was economically possible, I'm sure most companies would have done that already. What are your thoughts on some of that, on solving the access issue? Is there some new way to do that, or the only way forward is to continue to grow and get your products into as many retailers as possible? And by virtue of doing that, you automatically eventually reach the customers that most need it. I just want to figure out what companies can either do individually or even collectively to try to address some of these challenges, in addition to speaking about how sustainable they are and how better they are for the planet.
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. I mean, one of the things that you said is that, the vegan community is super white, and you're right. I think it's something like 8% of vegans are identify as African-American. But what's also interesting is that African-Americans are the fastest growing segment of people who are adopting veganism. So, I mean, I think one of the things that we can do is we can look at how we message to our potential consumers. What are we saying? What does our social media feeds look like? Are they representing a diverse group of people? Who are we really speaking to? And that's not going to change the financial accessibility question. But like you said, that's a more loaded answer, mm-hmm. because of meat cuts complexities. And like you said, it's kind of already stacked against us. So, you know, what can we do? How can we think about who we partner with when we are doing our social media partnerships? What bloggers are we communicating with? How does just the look of our feed? Are we, you know, if we're showing people on our feed with our food, are they only white people? Or are we trying to be more diverse because that's more reflective of the world that we're living in and bringing equal emphasis to the value that all kinds of people bring to the food community? What types of recipes do we share? And just really thinking about that a little more critically, I think is one way that we can open up that world to an audience that maybe is receptive to it, but is feeling excluded from it.
I also think too, I think there's something to be related here to that issue of kind of the difference between creating equality and creating equity around making an effort to a concerted effort to acknowledge and do something about the disadvantage that white privilege has essentially created. And how, as a company, can you respond to that when you're trying to connect with a diverse group of people? So it's not, you know, it's not just a question of equal, but it's a question of acknowledging like a disadvantage, I think, that has to be made up for in some way. And acknowledging, I think, that we don't have all the answers for that yet. But that I think that the first step there is acknowledging that you need to do something about that. And I also think too, I mean, you know, you can't leave price out of it. Yeah. Because it's definitely part of the equation. You know, I think for us, part of that is running a good business. You know, if we are more efficient, if we are less wasteful, if we are, you know, if our as a manufacturer, if our processes are better, you know, we can start to apply those efficiencies to the price of the product for consumers. We can also apply it internally to support our team. And that can be part of this conversation. Kind of both sides of that are part of this conversation in terms of creating equity. You know, so you can't understate that price issue, because in the end, most folks are making their decisions at the shelf around price.
and we have, we have done work on pricing too. I mean, you know, retailers like Walmart, we have a new reduced EDLP with them. So our everyday low price is now a dollar less than it used to be. I think we're at $5.99 with Walmart now. So that's one of the lowest places that you'll find us. And that's one of the things that we did to in part increase that accessibility piece. We know that most people in America, ourselves included, live closer to a Walmart than they do to a Whole Foods or another natural grocery retailer. And so the fact that we can show up on the shelf there at an everyday low price of $5.99 really does a lot to improve our access.
Yeah, all of what this conversation to me is leading up to this bigger question, really, that I think you're a very unique company. Even if you had to survey the plant-based food industry, you guys have always done things differently, even within the space that is considered to be different from the rest of the industry. And sometimes, and I guess in some ways, you can look at some of the recent challenges you've had as being just a result of, it's always, I don't want to use the word fun, but I think some people take pleasure in watching things that stand for something appear to not stand for it. I mean, it's enjoyable almost for some people to watch that happen. And a better way to probably frame it is like, how do you really succeed as a business and do good at the same time? Is it even possible if the system we're operating under is a flawed system to begin with, right? Capitalism is not perfect, but it is a system we have. When you're running a business, you've got to make these challenging decisions between, you want to grow and have the impact, because the only way to actually change the way people eat and to change the food system is to grow. But then you don't want to grow at the cost of your employees and at the cost of the environment, at the cost of the things that you value the most. So there's this constant push and pull of values and mission with, at the end, you have to sell stuff. And you've got to make money so you can pay people a fair wage. So it is, it's very complicated. It goes beyond just having, you know, making statements on Instagram or having a brand with a very big mission statement. And let's just say, you know, I can't think of one company that has, forget the food space, beyond that has truly figured it out. Often, mm-hmm. I'll give the example of like Patagonia and many others do as, oh, look at that company. They didn't go public. They chose to stay private. They do really odd things by telling you to send your clothes back and get them repaired. They stand for sustainability, but they're not perfect either. Let's mm-hmm. be clear. I'm very inspired by their story, and I think they often are used as a model of how to be conscious as a capitalist. But at the same time, they do a lot of the same things, and I'm sure you can find press out there about them doing a lot of the same tricks that you use to sell products while they claim to stand for a lot of things. And by no means is this designed to be a criticism of any company, especially not Patagonia. But it's really, I'm giving that example to illustrate this challenge of how do you do the right thing and be not evil, yet work within a system that perhaps is inherently evil, and where do you find that compromise to be maybe not perfect, but do the best you can? How do you, and I don't expect you to have all the answers on this one either.
I have a very concise answer. No.
But like, how do you navigate these challenges as you continue to grow and should grow, mm-hmm. because that's the only way you can change the world? How do you grapple with these issues? I'm sure it comes up a lot in your company. Mm-hmm.
It's really difficult to answer because in large part, like, it's a moving target. What is evil to you might be different to what is evil to me and what might be evil to someone down the street. And so I think that's why the genesis of our name is important to understand, is that no evil isn't about any particular single evil. It's not a hard stance of meat is evil or GMO food is evil or, you know, what have you is evil. It's more about our approach of trying to find the positive and do good. And so it's less about a mandate and more about an ambition and an aspiration to do better. And that can extend to anything because there's very little in this world that can't be improved upon.
I think that's sort of the right, I always think of it as an aspiration. Mm-hmm. You know, the name of our company is an aspiration to do better every day. And I think within that is to, as Sadra said, to evaluate almost every day, you know, the best thing to do and the best way to move forward and the best stance and the way to speak about something or the way to do business. And to sort of always have the question in your mind is like, is this the way to do this? Is there a better way to do this? Is there a different way to do it? And I think within the context of trying to make a huge difference, you know, for all the excitement around plant-based and plant-based meats in the last several years, you know, for us, plant-based meats is still this tiny, tiny little 1% of protein or meat in the United States right now. It's a tiny little thing. There's so much that we need to do to make, you know, a significant impact on the way people eat, that we think really hard about the best way to move forward when we really feel like there's so much to be accomplished by reaching so many more people with the message around why to make this food choice and how that is truly like such a such a revolutionary thing, really, because the system is still so much geared towards eating, you know, eating animal protein. And so I'm almost losing the genesis of the question, I think.
Yeah, I mean, but I guess, can you tackle that challenge without falling into the trap of being the same as those companies that created the problem in the first place? Mm-hmm. Can you truly not only shift protein consumption to plants and by virtue of doing that, make the world a better place, but can you use different tactics and be better in your process to achieve those end goals? Because one way of doing it is just growth at all costs. We don't care how it's done. Run your company however it needs to be done. Be as ruthless as possible with your partnerships, with your employees, with everyone, because at the end of the day, people will consume plants and that's what's most important. Or can you actually, you know, build a culture, a business strategy, partnerships that live out these values that you hold, or is it impossible? I guess the genesis of my question.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's essential to look at it. I don't know if both ways is the right way of putting it, but to look at both, you know, what you're trying to achieve and what you're trying to build as a community. You know, like we think of No Evil Foods as a community within a part of our, you know, the community where we are. And I think, you know, we're always trying to build the best company while also trying to sort of being a part of this bigger goal. You know, whether that's pay or benefits or cultural, you know, other cultural things about how we not do business out in the world, but do business here with each other and how we work together.
I think it's all to make that big impact. I mean, try to sum it up. In order to make that big impact and have that global effect that ultimately is our goal, it's still a series of small steps. Mm. Whether that means that the person at the grocery store is choosing to eat plant-based one day, that's their small step, but it also means small steps for our company too. It's, you know, choosing to invest in our people time and time again, even if our cash flow might not show that to be a wise decision, but we do it anyway because we personally feel that that's what needs to be done. And I think when you make those choices time and time again and make those tough calls, to do what's right repeatedly, that ultimately is how you get to where we want to go.
Yeah. Well, I think you summed that up pretty well. I think it's an aspiration, as you said, Mike. It's also, if you've got to know what you're working towards, and you've got to know where you stand on certain issues and what you value, and then you've got to live up to those values. It's obviously easier said than done, but having that aspiration is the starting point. I want to wrap up with something. I'll try to be positive. So let's try to get, I know this has been a challenging conversation, not because these are issues you're not willing to confront and we aren't willing to talk about. It's because there's no easy answers to most of these questions. Mm-hmm. So I appreciate, firstly, you taking the time to be open and vulnerable and to talk about things that you maybe don't have the clearest answers or definitely don't have any talking points around. And that in itself, I think, is a step forward. And I wish more people did that, because we can't get to where we need to go if we don't open ourselves up to questioning our own faults and also thinking about how we can do things better going forward. Mm-hmm. So talking about going forward, I mean, these are challenging times no matter how you look at it, for everyone. And I know it's tough to predict anything anymore, but if you had to be optimistic and hopeful, what do you think is going to come out of this strange phase for humanity? And you can answer this question generally about socially what's going to change, what you hope could change, politically what could change, or just, you know, focus on the food industry or just focus on your company. What one or couple of positives that you hope will come out of this strange and ever-changing time that we're living in right now?
Asking the tough questions, man. I hope that there's self-examination happening on all fronts and a renewed sense of kindness for one another. I think that that's been in short supply. People have been very quick to react to each other when there's a disagreement on a subject or political stance or a social issue. And I hope that throughout everything that's happening, that there's a sense of community that evolves from it. We all went through something, and that's very rare that we can have an event that we experience collectively and that impacts us, not all equally, because there's, you know, it has disproportionately impacted certain populations. But it's touched each and every one of us. No one has been spared from this, and it's very rare to have that sort of experience. And so I hope that throughout that we have a renewed sense of togetherness. I feel like a very hippie saying this right now, but more unity and more togetherness and kindness for one another. I think that would be a really positive and much needed outcome. And please go vote.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I can say it better. I'm going to try, but or differently. I guess I would just take it back to what we talked about earlier, which is how positive can come from challenge or come from, I don't want to say negative, I guess, but I just think there's so much to learn from an experience. I mean, we've seen in the last 6 months, collectively, as at least a country, if not a world, sort of a collection of experiences that, you know, it might take years to have all those things happen.
Very consolidated.
And they all happen, you know, in the same couple months, you know, from a pandemic to kind of the racial and social unrest, even those two things, for them to happen within the span of a couple months. But there's just so much good that can come out of that, so much improvement in the way that we, the way that companies do business, the way that we interact with each other, the way that we support each other, just as people, the way that we think about how we eat, why we make those choices, just how we can do better. I think there's a lot to learn about how can we do better. And the fact that these things have kind of focused us in on that question is such a really amazing opportunity. In so many different ways that it's hard to isolate. Mm-hmm. You sit down and think, like, how could we do better? There's so many different things you could be thinking about and so many positives that could come out of that, that, it, you know, it can, if you think about that, I think it can leave you encouraged for the future on the other side of these things, and, or, you know, just kind of moving through them and learning from them, that, like, how can we do better is such a great question to be asking yourself, you know, every day. And it ties me back to, I'll bring it just back to No Evil Foods, because that was the aspiration. It was, how can we do better? And we try to ask ourselves that, you know, and sometimes in an unconventional way, depending on what it is, but we always try to ask ourselves that about everything, is like, how can we do this better?
Sadra and Mike, thank you. It's as always, it's been a pleasure chatting with both of you.
For sure.
Thank you. Always nice to talk to you.
Yeah.
You've been listening to Eat for the Planet with Nil Zacharias. If you enjoyed this conversation and would like to show your support, please subscribe to the show and leave a review on Apple Podcasts. To learn more about how Eat for the Planet can help your brand or organization develop the right strategy, implement scalable operations, and grow responsibly, visit eftp.co. That's eftp.co. Let's rise up to the challenge of transforming our food system. Thank you for listening.
Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.